Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. So today I'm really excited to have with us Chris Chapinar. How do you say your last name, Chris?
You nailed it, Chapinar.
Chapinar. Okay, Chris Chapinar with Whiskey Noobs Podcast. And I've listened to a few of your podcasts recently, and I'm really loving it. Wow, a lot of great information. So where are you located, Chris?
Well, first of all, thank you. I appreciate the kind words there. And I am in Ohio. I'm kind of by the Pro Football Hall of Fame, like Canton, Ohio area.
Okay. All right. Great. Yeah, I'm in the Philadelphia area, so not too far away. But I haven't been to Canton. Some place I'd like to go, you know, but haven't been there yet. But I'll get there eventually.
Yeah. A lot of people are like, oh, I went to the Hall of Fame or something. And I'm like, I've actually lived here my whole life and never gone to the Hall of Fame. So
but great. Like, because you can go anytime you want. So
exactly.
I don't need to go today. I can go tomorrow.
Right. So then you take it for granted and still haven't been.
Right. That's like the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Like people are like, have you been to the Liberty Bell? Well, let's see. I think I was like 10. Right. Sure. I mean, I've been there probably on a field trip with like, you know, some elementary school or something.
Right. Yep.
Yep. So did you grow up there?
Yeah. Grew up in the Canton area, moved a little bit, like not very far for a little while, and now back to the Canton area. So born and raised.
Oh, fantastic. And, so how did you get into this whole bourbon thing?
Great question. Yeah. So I got into bourbon itself or whiskey in general itself, because my dad was always into whiskey. And you know, it's one of those things, this is like the marketing is really good at this these days too, where when you see somebody enjoying it, you're like, I want that. Like that right. Seems like they're really liking it, you know? Yeah. So as soon as I came of age to drink, I tried it. Not too big of a fan at first.
Yeah.
And then over a little bit of time, I actually got into cigars. And then when I started pairing cigars with whiskey, I was like, okay, I think I like this whiskey thing. And then from there was your typical slippery slope of like, oh, now this is my favorite thing and I want to try every single one of them.
Right. So did you go the Scotch route first or the bourbon route first?
Actually, my first bottle that I bought for myself, I believe, was Scotch. I think it was Monkey Shoulder, if I'm not mistaken. But I wasn't loyal to any one. I did, if it wasn't Monkey Shoulder, it was Maker's Mark 46. Those were both very early. I don't remember which one I bought first. I think it was Monkey Shoulder. But yeah, I wasn't loyal to any category. I was like, I want to try all of these. And I was so blown away by how different they tasted that it just made me want to try more categories, more different types.
Right. Fantastic. So where did the name Whiskey Noobs come from?
Yeah. So a little ways along that journey, I got to where I really wanted a podcast to listen to help get me into it. So I've always been the type of person where like I find new hobbies, new groups of people, especially the ones that get like cult followings. I find them really intimidating. And I'm like, I don't want to, you know, I'm scared to go to a bar and order whiskey neat. And with cigars, I'm scared to go to a lounge because those people all know each other. And so I thought, well, I want to come up with a podcast for people like me where you're like scared, you want to know the basics, you want to feel confident talking about it. And so I started listening to some, and there are some phenomenal podcasts out there. At the time, it was significantly less saturated, and there were really good ones that weren't doing exactly what I wanted. They weren't really fitting that, what I just described. And so I thought, well, I had had a little bit of experience with podcasting and recordings, things like that. So I thought, I bet I could come out with that myself. So from there, I was like, let's just try to do it, see what happens, and started producing the podcast, started advertising it on the short form platforms. And then that's when things really kind of took off.
And why the name, though? Why Whiskey Noobs?
Oh yeah, so the noobs in the beginning is because it's catering to new people. So in like gaming especially, you'll call somebody a noob or a newbie. And so that was kind of like, this is for the newbies, this is for the new folks.
Gotcha. That's a good name though. I mean, because it says something, and you're very educational in what you're doing. I mean, you're talking, I was listening to a couple episodes, one recent one, you were talking about the barrels and the toasting and all that stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is in depth. This is really teaching people about how it's done. And, you know, you had the little barrel that you buy, you know, in the store that, you know, you're like, oh, you can't just throw it in here and expect it to be Buffalo Trace in 2 years. You know, it doesn't work that way. I thought that was great because I tried that. It didn't work.
Right. right. It's all off the rite of passage.
All the whiskey was gone in like 2 years. I checked the barrel, and like 2 years later, there was nothing in the barrel at all. It was just all evaporated.
Yep. Yeah, those are almost a rite of passage. And they're fun if you use them, you know, for what they're made for. But when you did it, I did it, we all do it. When you try to age something super long in it, it doesn't tend to work out, yeah.
Right. So when you started getting into this, you know, what did your family say? Like, were they like, oh, this is so great, this is exciting, Chris? Or are they like, are you nuts? Like,
a little bit of both. Definitely excited. I mean, they thought it was very cool. I was kind of the first person in my family to go out and do something like that on the internet, which with it came the opposite. Came the like, I think one of the first things my sister said when I told her about it was, you used your real name? And I was like, I didn't even think about that. I was like, should I not have? And so there was a little bit of the fear, a little bit of the unknown, but overall very supportive. And then especially as things picked up steam, you know, it's not like I immediately quit my job or anything like that, which eventually I moved towards self-employment. But in the beginning, it wasn't. So it was like they were always just very supportive. This is so cool, and always just happy for me with how that was going. So that was also a really big help, especially in the early days, having people to help you bring up your numbers, help you with some reviews and listen to it, give you feedback. What didn't they like about it? That was very helpful from the beginning.
Right. I saw a post too that maybe you're married. You said something like, you know, does your wife want you to have more expensive hobbies?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think my wife is very glad I stopped at this expensive hobby because I got onto the side of TikTok that has watches and stuff there for a while. And I was like, ooh, but one expensive hobby at a time.
Yeah, one expensive hobby at a time. Yeah, I've gone through a few myself, and one was motorcycles, and I realized that that's a good way to die. So I thought, maybe a sports car instead, you know, like at least four wheels anyway. And I ended up buying an Aston Martin on the used and then souped it up a little bit because I drove some Aston Martin race cars in Abu Dhabi one time. And on a racetrack, and it was experience of a lifetime. Really, really fun.
Yeah, I am so lucky that I don't have that bug because my day job was in automotive, and a lot of my friends that I worked with really have the car bug. And luckily, it never got me. There was one time I got to drive a new Audi, and I was like, because what I learned from that I liked was like more so the comfort style, like not as much the sporty driving fast, that sort of a thing. But I was like, okay, all the comfort, all the add-ons this car has, I could get used to. And I had to pretty quickly be like, no, one expensive hobby at a time, Chris.
Definitely. So for your bourbon hobby, like when you, I don't know if you've been married for a long time or just a short time, it doesn't really matter. But what did you serve at your wedding?
Oh, that's a fun story, actually. So I have been married for about 4 years now. And at our wedding, so we only served the venue had built-in bartending, everything. Right. So they had built-in packages that we picked. I think the bourbon was Jim Beam. And then they also made a drink for it. They made like a kind of a riff on an old-fashioned, made a little bit sweeter to appeal to the guests.
Sure.
And then they let us bring one of our own bottles as long as the bartenders served it. So my dad, my whole life, has been a Jack Daniels guy. So we were like, let's go get a really nice Jack Daniels. Well, we landed on gold number 27 because it's finished in the maple barrels. So it makes it like real sweet and just a nice thing to have on your wedding day. So we bought this bottle, which at the time was the most expensive bottle I'd ever had. And I think I was very new to it at the time. I probably had about 10 to 15 bottles. So most expensive bottle. And we go to the bar and we say, here's a list. These are people who are allowed to drink from this. And, you know, these people will come up. They know what they're asking for. Serve it to these people. Shortly after the reception started, I go up and I'm like, hey, can I have some of the Jack Daniels number 27? And they knew that I was the groom. They're like, absolutely. They're pouring it for me. And there's like 3 ounces left in the bottle. And I said, oh. Who came up and got some of this? And they were like, well, I don't know. So I went and asked my dad. I said, have you been drinking a lot of that Jack Daniels or giving it to people? And he said, no. Come to find out, anytime somebody walked up and ordered a Jack and Coke, they were using that because they had Jim Beam and they had Jack Daniels. They're like, they ordered Jack and Coke. So somebody didn't get the list somewhere along the way. Yeah. So at the time it was tragic, but looking back, it's funny.
That is funny. So here's a out of the box question for you that I'm dealing with right now. So yeah. I'm about to go on a trip, whitewater rafting down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. Nice. And I can bring basically one whiskey. And I have this, they told you, you really should have a plastic bottle, not thermal insulated. So I got this 25-ounce plastic Yeti bottle. And the reason for that, I think, is because to keep it cool, they're going to drag it along. You carabiner it to a rope, and they're going to drag it along through the river because the river's cold.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the air is like up to 100 degrees down there. Wow. It's really hot and dry. But I still have to decide what to put in this. What would you put in this?
Oh man, that's a great question. So I have to fire back with the question. So is it just for you, or do you have friends coming? And if you have friends coming, what's their experience?
Excellent question. So my wife went to Kentucky with me, and she just in April, and she sort of experienced bourbon for the first time and started to like it for the first time. And then I have a couple of friends who are coming as well. They are interested, but I don't think they drink a lot of bourbon. So I'm hoping to share it. I'm hoping for something that is, you know, shareable, that people would just sort of more instantly take to and wouldn't be difficult for them. Something approachable.
Okay. Well, you just made my job easy for me, because if your wife is interested in it, it's got to be whatever she likes, right? But if I did have to pick a bottle, those who listen to me probably think by now that Redwood Empire just keeps me on retainer, because I absolutely love Redwood Empire's Pipe Dream. Okay. And I think that is just one of my favorites for sharing with newer people. They just tend to really like it. It's got enough flavor that they're like, this doesn't taste like alcohol.
Right.
But it also is approachable enough that it doesn't scare people away. That's kind of the line you have to walk with newer.
Is that like a 90?
90, I believe.
90 proof. I was looking at like Four Roses, and you know, I usually, if I'm getting a Four Roses for me, I'll usually get like the single barrel, you know, small batch, select, whatever, you know, pay a little extra for all that stuff. And I'm like, you know what? It's going to be dragged through the Colorado River.
True.
And I don't know what the temperatures are going to be like. It's going to be experiencing a lot of temperature change. So I'm not going to go with an expensive,
right?
Something inexpensive, you know, and I put my Four Roses back on the shelf and, you know, started looking around a little bit more.
Absolutely. And if you want to get really inexpensive, my go-to is always Evan Williams Bottled and Bond. That's like one of my favorite bottles for the value of all time.
I love it too. I have a couple of those, and I took a picture of one for Instagram once, and I put on there, I know you wrote me off, but I'm really good.
Yes, that's so true. Yes.
Because I think people are like, oh, I got to go get the Penelope $160 or the whatever, you know, the Pappy or whatever it is, the Weller's, whatever. And it's like, yeah, but you know what? Some of these less expensive ones are actually really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially some people, if they go that inexpensive, they'll only ever mix with it. And so they never really get to taste it for what it is. And it's mind blowing. I've done lots of blind tastings with Bottled and Bond, and it wins. It's beaten. I think the most expensive that it beat was like a $50 bottle. And I was completely floored by it. I couldn't believe it.
Wow. That's something. That's really good. So Bottled and Bond. So talk about that a little bit for our listeners. What does that mean?
Yeah, Bottled and Bond. This is a great example of how America really grew up with bourbon, because it was the first ever consumer protection law in the United States, and it was about liquor. And it applied to lots of liquors, but it was made because of bourbon. At the time, you could get away with selling a lot of different things and passing it off as bourbon, dumping very disgusting and nefarious things into your barrels to darken it and make it look like it was aged more. And so they came out with the Bottled and Bond Act of, I think it was 1897, if I'm remembering that correctly, somewhere around that time. And they came out with it so that they could make sure that they knew consumers were actually getting what was being advertised. Right. And so with Bottled and Bond, there's a bunch of different requirements that you have to meet, but the most important are, it's got to be exactly 100 proof. It's got to be aged for at least 4 years, and it has to be aged and handled and bottled under government supervision. So the government is actually signing off on this, saying, this is bourbon whiskey if it is labeled as bourbon whiskey.
Right.
And so you have to actually be in a bonded government warehouse, which is where Bottled and Bond, that's kind of where that comes from. It's like a bond with the government. The government is signing off and saying it is what you say it is.
Right. And are you allowed to finish it?
I don't believe so with any Bottled and Bond, but you might have got me there. I don't know if I know that.
I don't know either. I'm not. That's why I'm asking. I'm not really sure if you're allowed to finish it. I think you might not be allowed to, which makes it even more amazing that some of them are really good.
Yeah, you might not be allowed to. The one way that I could see a distillery getting around that would be that they could say, potentially, I don't know, this might not go through the TTB. They might be able to say Bottled and Bond bourbon, finished in blah blah blah. So it's kind of like, oh, it used to be Bottled and Bond bourbon, but now it's finished in whatever. They do the same thing with bourbon. It's bourbon finished in port barrels. It's not just bourbon full stop.
Right. All right. Another crazy question. Like, so, you know, okay, when you're what's your whiskey that you like to, you know, drink when you're, you know, having a burger versus, you know, having like a nice dinner with your wife out at a Chilean sea bass or something like that, or a filet? What are you drinking?
Yeah, well, when I'm having like a, let's say like a burger or something like that, I tend to go, Evan Williams Bottled and Bond, I kind of gave it away there in the beginning, because that is my like sub $30-ish dollar just go to. Another one that I'd throw out there is Cooper's Craft Barrel Reserve. It's right around that $30 range. Fantastic flavor. Very dark and oaky. And just, yeah, for the price, it's fantastic. Then if I move up to like something a little bit nicer, one of my favorite like mid-shelf available at a lot of restaurants drinks is Woodford Reserve Double Oaked. If I keep giving recommendations, you'll start to notice I love oaky stuff. I'm always going for something with a lot of oak to it. Woodford Double Oaked is fantastic. And then also something I tend to do a lot at weddings or at like nice restaurants, I tend to go for scotch. I don't know why. I don't know if I've just Pavloved myself into associating weddings with scotch or what, but I love a good scotch, or I should say a single malt, because sometimes I'll do American single malts. Right now, my favorite single malt at the moment is Westward Whiskey's Milestone Release Number 2. Just a phenomenal blend. It's got everything you want. It's got the maltiness. It's got the depth of flavor. It's got even like some cocoa notes, some strange things going on, cinnamon. That one I'm really enamored with at the moment.
Have you tried the Angel's Envy Triple Oak?
I haven't. I saw it in my Discord chat and I was like, I might need to try that one, but I haven't. Have you had it?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I went to the store and I got a couple of bottles of it because I didn't know it was going to be so ubiquitous everywhere. I was like, oh my goodness, this is unusual. So I bought a couple and they're almost $100 a piece. So I was like, I'm going to invest a couple hundred bucks in this and see. They're very good. I really liked it. I didn't find it to be over oaked or real tanny and tannins and stuff like that. It's just lots of flavor.
Okay, well, that's good. And that's like three different finishing casks they blend together. Am I right about that? I don't remember for sure. Okay.
Yeah, it's I think it's Angel's Envy, and then it's like put it in one, then put it in two, then put it in three.
Okay.
Three different barrels to get that, you know, finishing that they're looking for.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense. I love oaky, so.
What do you think about, like, I'm not picking on anybody, but Jefferson's, you know, they take their whiskey and they're like, we're going to put it on a ship. And that gives it that, we're shaking it up, you know, a little bit kind of. I think that's a little gimmicky because it's not really temperature related.
I think a little bit of both for sure. I think Jefferson's is a great example because I think it is almost like a gimmick that works, but it only works sometimes. So like I've had some voyages, and I don't know the numbers because they were buddies, that were phenomenal. And then of course I went out and bought myself one because I'm like, this is fantastic. And I got, I think it was like Voyage 27 or 28, and I didn't like it at all. And it was like really like briny and just like it made you pucker up a little bit. I do think there's something to it affecting the aging, though, just because of the extra exposure to the wood, kind of like mixing it up more. Yeah. It's kind of like if you're steeping your tea, the difference between letting the bag just sit in the tea versus like stirring it at the same time, and it's going to help it steep a little bit more. So I think there's something to it. I do think some brands, and I don't like to talk badly, but so I'm not going to say any names, but there are some brands that do get carried away with it, right. And where it's like, we have this super unique aging thing that we do, and it's not actually very unique. I think the biggest one that is real by far is the climate. If you move it up north, if you move it down south, you're getting different flavors for sure.
And I've only been doing these interviews for a while, and I've interviewed a bunch of distilleries, and some in Texas, Florida, Denver, you know, all over, right? And you know, everybody's got their own reasons why their climate is good. You know, down in the hot climates, it's like, well, it ages faster. You know, it's like it's hot. You know, it's like it's expanding into the barrel and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, and one guy even made the point, he's like, well, why do you think that a scotch can be aged for 28 years and a bourbon can't? Is because it gets so cold in Scotland that it's kind of sucked into the barrel and it kind of goes dormant. For 4 months, 5 months, 6 months out of every year, it's not doing anything. It's not picking up any flavors. It's not doing anything. It's not going in and out and moving around. It's just dormant for a long period of time. So it takes twice as long to age a scotch as it does to age a bourbon. So there's a little something to this whole temperature. And the guy up in Denver, he's talking about barometric changes because they get all these storms and, you know, and then moving it from like 5,000 feet up to, you know, Steamboat Springs at, you know, 8,000 feet for a couple of years, doing a couple extra years up there, bringing it back down, you know, down to the Denver area for another couple of years and, you know, just moving it around, things like that. It's very interesting. Everybody's got their little, their thing. Have you run into any people like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You're totally right. That like every distiller kind of has their own thing. They've got something that they're proud of. One that I thought was really interesting, and I never did any science or research to back this up, but I've heard that humidity plays a huge role in whether your proof is going to go up or down because it depends on whether you're losing water or not as you're aging. So if I'm not mistaken, it's higher humidity, your proof goes down because you're not evaporating off that water. You're actually getting some water from the environment. So it totally has a huge impact on it. And it also isn't quite as simple as some distillers boil it down to where ours ages faster, so we only need a 5-year. Well, to some extent, yes, it's going to get more oaky. It's going to get more tannic. But also, it's not just going to taste like it was aged faster. It's going to taste a little different. It's not just going to taste like a 10-year that was aged in a cold climate. Something different happens because of the speed that it is interacting with the barrel as well.
Right. So do you have any bourbon questions that you'd like to ask God?
Oh, man, that's a good one. Ooh. I'll say something controversial. No, I won't say that.
Come on, go ahead. We could use it in a clip or something, you know, it'd be fun.
That's a tough one. Well, I will say, why Buffalo Trace with that most recent flood? What? Why'd you do that?
Yeah, I was there that week when it was just storming like crazy. And my wife and I and a couple of friends got there. And I think it was the very first night, man. It was just like tornado warnings and the sirens went off. We were in Louisville. Mm-hmm. The sirens are going off and you could hear the wind just whipping and you're like, wow, this is quite a storm. And after that, it just kept raining and raining and raining for days. And we moved over about 30, 40 minutes outside of Louisville and we were in like horse farm area, right? And sort of near like Bullitt and those sorts of places. And, we were on this horse farm and you could look out and way down there by the creek, you could see a three rail fence.
Okay. Right?
And first day you could see the three rail fence. The second day, the fence only had two rails. The third day it only had one. And the next day it had zero rails.
Oh, so my goodness,
coming up higher and higher. And there was, it was kind of sloping down to this thing and the water just kept coming up higher and higher and coming up the ground level. So that it was like, we're going to be stuck here, you know? So we were on an Airbnb. So I contacted the host. I'm like, so is there another way out of here just in case? They're like, yeah. If you can't get over the little river, the bridge is closed or something, you can come out this back way or whatever. And I was like, okay, we didn't need to do that, but it was like, wow, man, there is so much water. And then Buffalo Trace, man, we were supposed to go there the day they closed. We had an appointment for a tour there, and to talk to them. And it's like, ended up, I did get one of these interviews with Harlan Wheatley, the master distiller at Buffalo Trace. Mm-hmm. So that's like episode 3, I think, of this series. But it was all closed down. And I was like, really? Is it really closed down? They're like, and then you see the pictures. You're like, oh, yeah, it's closed. Yeah. It's under 6 feet of water, the whole place.
Yeah, and I had no idea the extent of it until I saw that. It's like a really popular video right now where they go up like the years they marked all the different floods and it just keeps going and going and going. And then there's the flood we just had. I'm like, oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was something a little bit scary. But if I had to give a serious answer, I feel like I gave a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek answer. So my serious answer would be, are there any bourbons that were truly like significantly better back in the day? Like, you know, everybody's into dusties right now. They want to get these old bottles that aren't produced anymore. I'm like, mm-hmm. Are there any that were just truly spectacular, knock your socks off? Or have we continued to get better at making bourbon over the course of the years?
I would like to ask, like, why did it take, you know, I don't know, a million years or some 10,000 years or whatever to come up with bourbon in the first place?
right.
What took so long?
Yeah, no kidding. I guess it did at least come to us from the monks, the monks distilling their perfumes. So right. So they'll be like, I gave it to you eventually.
Yeah, and like the Evan Williams Experience, I don't know if you've ever been to that, but in Kentucky, you're going through and they got this whole tour and this experience and they're talking all about it. And they're like, the first reason that people were doing it is because they had too much corn. There's so much mm-hmm. corn around here. You got to do something with it or it's just going to rot in the field. So like, well, what are we going to do with it? Like, well, let's distill it because we can turn it into liquid and, you know, then we can use it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that was kind of it.
Yeah, and that's a great example of how America really grew up with bourbon, kind of like I mentioned there in the beginning. It's amazing to see how culture, agriculture, all those things were influenced and influenced whiskey and bourbon and our whole liquor industry, really.
And what's your like scotch? I like scotch, too. I mean, my journey has started with scotch. And, you know, so, you know, what's your experience with scotch? Like, have you, you know, what do you think? What are you thinking on scotch versus bourbon?
My experience with scotch is a lot more limited than my experience with bourbon. But I have had quite a few bottles. I especially really incorporated them into the podcast in the early days. What's my experience with scotch? I love it, but I do, it, for me, it's like a, I need to be in the mood kind of a thing. Whereas like bourbon's almost like a daily driver where I just like, I, on any given day, odds are I'd be looking forward to a glass of bourbon. If I was going to be drinking that night, of course, whereas with scotch, it's more so like I need to be in the mood. Like I said, weddings for some reason, I'm like, oh, this seems like a nice time for a scotch. But especially peated scotches, I like really, really need to be in the mood. The ones that have that real smoky boldness, right, that tastes like a campfire. In the fall, I do tend to love peated scotches.
Right.
But I don't really have a say as to whether it's better or worse than bourbon as much as it's just different. And it's really interesting. Kind of like you mentioned with the barrels, you can age it so much longer because it's in these cold climates. And instead of getting these super duper oaky, almost aggressive notes when you age it for 20 years, it gets this like light and sometimes tropical flavor from it. I think it's a... Honabunahabin, what's the other one? Brooklady, the classic Laddie, has this like really coconutty, like creamy flavor to it. That's so right. Weird. So that's what I love about it. It's just so different, and it's a new kind of adventure.
It is a new. All of this is an adventure. And I was just over in Scotland about a year ago, and it had been about 20 years since I was there previously. And mm-hmm. You know, I went over with a couple of friends, and we were just like, well, you know, what do you want to do in Scotland? Like, you know, I play golf, but I was the only one. So we're like, let's skip the golf. Let's just go around to distilleries.
That's awesome.
We went to as many as we could, and we tried every town we were in. We would ask about, like, what's the best scotch bar in this town where we can get, you know, and what are you looking for? And like, well, looking for something that you can't buy in America, because mm-hmm. anything I can buy in America, I can just buy it in America. You know, so yeah, let's try to find something different, something unique, something unusual, and ask about it. And you know, we tried probably 28 different ones while we were there, and really, really good. I think Aberfeldy was my favorite, and I don't remember why. It might have been just the right amount of peat and not too much, but it was really good.
Good to know. I have not had that one yet. I've heard of the name, but I haven't had it yet before. And I also, it's funny that you said about the peat. I am finding myself leaning more towards these in the middle ones. They're like a little bit peaty. I think Johnny Walker is the best known for doing this, where they'll blend some stuff that has no peat at all with things that have a little bit.
Right.
And I'm starting to find myself liking that, like just the light touch of peat, rather than I'm either drinking coconut milk or I'm eating a bonfire. Those right, are your right, other two right. options.
Yeah, if it's got too much, then you don't really, I don't know, you lose the other flavors. I mean, that's the beauty of bourbon, I guess, is that, you know, you get a good bourbon with all these different layers to it, all these different complexities, all these different flavors. And it's kind of, I gotta say, it's amazed me in this journey of learning about bourbon that stuff is real. You know, like, yeah, I know right. people exaggerate, and, you know, it's like when people talk about, you know, it tastes like dried leather and tobacco. I said, well, when was the last time you tasted tobacco or dried leather? You know, you know what that tastes like.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, it's been fun. And like my go-to scotch used to be the Macallan's, which is really quite good and kind of world famous. You know, either the 12 or the 18 year are just both fantastic, just really good.
So. Yeah. And those are, and I think they get so popular as well because they're also so complex, just like you mentioned, like you can find those notes, but also so approachable, which is something that bourbon struggles with sometimes, is it can be so incredibly complex, but not the most approachable for an audience that doesn't like slightly more aggressive flavors.
Right.
So I think that just makes it like this really nice balance.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And yeah, you know, I'm a investor type of guy too. So, you know, I've Macallan's has been in business a long time, and there's Macallan's 100-year-old Scotch, and there's only 8 bottles left. And good story is that the guy who bought the 9th bottle dropped it.
I didn't know that. No way.
$1 million bottle of Scotch dropped on the floor. He's a Japanese guy, and unfortunately he dropped his $1 million bottle of scotch.
Oh no. That's terrible.
What a shame, right? He's like, he's probably thinking, do I ever drink this? That would be crazy to drink $1 million bottle of scotch. Like, maybe I should save it. But you can't save it forever. You got to use it at some point, right? I guess. I don't know.
Right.
Like you said, maybe at a wedding or something, you know, would be a great time to, you know, but you got to hold it yourself, apparently. That's the moral of your story.
Don't give it to the bartenders.
Hang on to that bottle. Put it right there in your, you know, your coat breast pocket and like, hey, this is special.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when, you know, a question for you, like you walk into a party with your wife and you see people leaning over and go, oh, hey, that's Chris. What do you think they're saying?
Good question. I hope only good things. I think so. If I had to bet money as to what they were saying, especially if it's somebody that I don't know and there's just like it's about the content, I would bet money it's about my Better Than Blanton's series that I did when I was first on social media, because that's the only series I've done, lots of series to try to get them to catch on. That's the only one that to this day, just last week, actually, people will walk up to me and say, I love that Better Than Blanton series that you did. And I'm like, do I just do it again? Like, right. What do I do? Because right. It's just so popular, you know, but right. I'm like, I'll come up with something a little different.
Was it so popular?
I think it was just the perfect time. So I started it right in the thick of COVID when anybody would talk about on the forums, anybody who was new to bourbon, all they would talk about is getting that first bottle of Blanton's. Right. And so I did a whole series where I did dozens of bottles against Blanton's and blind tastings. And the real problem why I couldn't go back to doing it is I just got to where I knew immediately which one was the Blanton's. So it was more so just like I didn't know what the other bottle was, which was still a good comparison.
Right.
And so I think it just really caught on because it really showed. I have no idea what this other bottle is. It could be $100. It could be $10. It could be Evan Williams bottled and bond for $20. And sometimes those cheaper bottles beat it. I think Michter's Small Batch was one of the first ones to beat it. And I think people really like the authenticity of that.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. So if your personality was a bourbon, what would the tasting notes be?
Oh, what a clever question. I need to think about this. I think it would be, okay, I think it would be one of those classic bourbons where when you first take a sip, it's nice and sweet and approachable, but then has a little bit of pop later. And the reason I say that is I try to be the kindest person that I can be and be really approachable to everybody. And I like to think I do a good job of that. But I also tend to be the type of person that I don't filter myself too much. I tend to very nicely, not rudely, try to make sure my actual opinion is being put out there, try to be as honest as I can. And so to me, that just reads as one of those bourbons where you take a sip of it. I'm trying to think of a good example of this, but you take a sip of it and it's so immediately sweet. And then when you swallow it, that finish, you're like, oh, there's some black pepper. There's a little bit of something weird going on there.
Yeah.
I think that'd be me.
Spicy, maybe a little spicy in that personality.
right. Exactly.
Right. That's great. And if you were crossing the country on a long road trip, you know, what would you be playing? What music would you be playing?
Oh, all of it. I play my road trip playlist. I have no idea how long it is. I play all of it. So usually when I start out a road trip, I'm starting with something a little bit of like fun going on. So like maybe there's some alternative rock in there, even some like hip hop, sometimes a little bit of pop, like it's just the upbeat stuff. And then I'll usually end up throwing on country music for a while. That's a great, just like in the background, have that going. You can talk with like my wife while I'm driving, and it's just like a nice thing to have in the background. And then I end up on my classic rock playlist, which is just insanely long, and that one plays for a super long time, especially like if she's asleep because she doesn't like classic rock as much as I do. Then that's when the classic rock playlist comes on.
I have a classic rock playlist. I was just talking to my family about it, and they were here for last week, and they're like, oh, how come it only has like 110 songs? I'm like, well, I'll tell you why. Because in order to make this list, I don't care how popular you were, you cannot have more than two songs on this list.
Oh, so, okay.
That's it. You get two. So, you know, pick your favorite artist. Doesn't really matter how many songs they made. You get two. So you can change them. You can change them once in a while. You can swap one out, but you get two. You know, so we're not going to have a playlist that has, you know, 47 Journey songs on it, you know, or whatever, you know, or all of, you know, Dark Side of the Moon or you know, all of AC/DC. No, it's like, then it's just an AC/DC playlist, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's actually really poetic because that goes really greatly also with my whiskey selection. I kind of do the same thing where I'm like, listen, I love your finishes and you do a great job, but this is the 20th one you've released this year and I can't just have my entire shelf be this brand. Like, I need some space for other bottles.
Right, right. And that is the problem with the bourbon world right now is there's too many.
Yeah, it's so saturated, right?
And there's a few going bankrupt and some problems going on and various. I was just reading about Uncle Nearest and like his party house up in, you know, the vineyard up in you know, Massachusetts and stuff, and I'm like, you know, really interesting stuff going on. So but you know, I think you're right. You know, when COVID was happening, it became super popular. People were at home, they were more likely to, you know, take a drink every day. When people got busy again and now they're working back in the offices and, you know, all these big companies have called all their employees back, you know, not as much going on, and it's hard for everybody to get shelf space. So, you're right. The idea of the song having only two from each artist, same thing with the whiskey, man. You get two, you get your two best and that's it. That's all you get.
Yep. And it's perfect, too, because you can swap the songs out. And if I finish this bottle, sure, I'll go try that new release that you just came out with.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, that's pretty much all I had for you today. Just a quick, you know, 20, 30, 40 minute chat. And, you know, you've been a great guest and I really enjoy your podcast. It's fabulous. I encourage everybody to check it out. Whiskey Noobs. It's really, really good. If you're a newbie, and even if you're not a newbie, I mean, you've got depth. I mean, it's not just for noobs. It is for noobs, but you've also got depth and there's real meat on those bones. And it's a really great podcast and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I really do try to walk that line. I try to make it in-depth enough that I almost called it Whiskey Nerds way back in the beginning. And I tried to make it in-depth enough that the whiskey nerds love it, but I wanted to be more approachable. So I went with noobs and I try to make it, while it's in depth, I try to describe it as clearly as possible and make it so that if you're newer to whiskey, it's not scary. And I'm also goofy. So that also makes it less intimidating.
Yeah, it definitely makes it fun. And that's what we're trying to do here as well. We're trying to, you know, educate, but also we've got shenanigans going on. You know, it's like, so, you know, if somebody's doing something crazy, we want to talk about that too. So
100%. Exactly.
So, well, thank you very much, Chris.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. This has been great.
All righty. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, it's time for the shenanigans portion of this particular episode. And I wanted to go over maybe some shenanigans, but also took a couple of trips recently to Texas and visited a place called the Giant Distillery. They claim to be the largest distillery west of the Mississippi. And certainly they had a institutional feel to it. It was big. And they have a lot of capacity to grow at this location that they're at. Met with Julian Giraldo. He is the master distiller at Giant. And they're doing some interesting business. I mean, a lot of their whiskey, a lot of their bourbon is still pretty young. It's generally less than 8 years old. But they also do some interesting business by bottling other people's bourbon and whiskey because they have a strong manufacturing facility. So they bottle for the Prideful Goat, an Indiana distillery, and others, which they cannot name. This particular institutional plant that they're operating out of used to be an Uncle Ben's rice plant where they made all the Uncle Ben's rice. And you can tell there's still stuff up on the ceiling where the rice travels from one place to another. And it's a pretty cool place. I went with some friends. We all had a great time. We enjoyed trying all of their whiskeys. They're all quite good. We really enjoyed it a lot. Tried the Prideful Goat whiskey too. Really excellent. I did a flight of the rye whiskeys, and Prideful Goat and Giant were both in there, both very good. I'd probably put the Prideful Goat a little bit ahead of them, but still the Giant was very good. They're just beginning to work on their finishing techniques, so things should be continuously improving at the Giant Distillery. They told me an interesting story. So Julian told me that originally when they came out with their products, their bottle, and he showed it to me, looked way too much like a Jack Daniel's bottle. And it did. It looked pretty much identical to a Jack Daniel's shape of a bottle. And they got sued for that. So they had to change the shape of their bottle. And now they're going with a sort of squatty, fat-bottomed whiskey bottle with a long neck on it. And it kind of looks like, the bottle that you rub to get a genie to come out of it. You know, like I Dream of Genie. You rub the bottle and poof, you know, a genie pops out the top. So kind of cool. Had a good time with that. One of the other distilleries we went to is much more known, I'd say, is Still Austin. So we traveled up from the Houston area where Giant is located to Austin. We visited Still Austin. It was Friday night. There really wasn't anybody around to interview or talk to about anything. But I was, again, with a bunch of friends. We had a good time. We tried a bunch of their different bourbons and whiskeys, and they were really, really good. I would say both of these places are using all Texas grains, which is interesting because, you know, I kind of feel like there's a band across the United States of where the best corn is grown. And you can find that band on a map. If you look, start in Iowa and start coming east and go through Illinois and Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And this is where really your best sweet corn, Kentucky, is grown. You know, not in Texas, but they're doing the best they can. And they're putting together some really nice products. Still Austin, again, I don't think it's quite up to Kentucky levels. I wasn't overly impressed with it. I tried their high proof, very complex whiskey bourbon that they had there. Thought it was very good. You know, I'm guessing like maybe 3 stars out of 5. And the Giant, I'm thinking maybe 2.7, 2.8 stars out of 5. But these are nowhere close to the best bourbons you can buy or the best whiskeys you can buy out there. And I would say also that Still Austin charges a good amount for their stuff. A basic bottle of bourbon, I believe, was $60 I paid for it. That's kind of high, especially since, you know, I would say a $26 of Buffalo Trace is better. So, you know, I should rank it lower just because it's overly expensive. And the high proof stuff, I think it was about 110, 120 range, was very good. But again, it was like, what was it? $90, something like that for a bottle. So I think they're charging a pretty good amount, and it's a decent product. It really is. It's a good product. I think they're overcharging for it. I don't think it's quite there yet. It's very good. And what I mean quite there yet, I mean, is it comparable to, you know, your really nice products that you're going to get out of Kentucky? Because they're charging like it's a nice product. They're charging MSRPs like, you know, Colonel Taylor and, you know, Eagle Rare and, you know, places like, you know, things like that. You know, Woodford, high-end stuff, and your Maker's Mark 46 or 47, whatever that number is. I think it's 46. What they charge for their stuff, Angel's Envy, stuff like that. So, you know, if you're going to charge that much, you got to be good. And they're, when I say they're not quite there, I mean, I don't think they should be charging that much. So that's just my review. I thought that the products were excellent. I enjoyed trying them out. You know, but that's where I think they stand in the pecking order out there. So now back to the NFL. All right, you guys. I've said it before, and I get to say it again this week. I am not a Jets fan. They won another football game. Holy smokes. I mean, there's plenty of words you can say, like even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while. A broken clock is right twice a day. Whatever you want to call it, these guys win a game every once in a while by accident. And I feel sorry for you if you're a Jets fan. And you know what? If you're a Jets fan, you would probably get mad and say, well, I feel sorry for you because you're a Steelers fan. And you're right. I feel sorry for me, too. I went to that Steelers game yesterday. Oh, my gosh. Buffalo came to town and the Steelers, they didn't lay an egg. They crapped an egg. I mean, it was awful. It was one of the worst games I've ever seen the Steelers play. The offense was horrendous. There was 18 minutes of possession time by the Steelers. It was bad, ladies and gentlemen. It was serious garbage. The fans were angry. They were booing left and right. I've never seen this before. If you've been to a Steelers game, you know that they play Renegade from Styx. That's kind of their song. Usually sometime in the fourth quarter, when the defense takes the field and we need a big stop, all of a sudden, the lights go out. The stadium gets loud, the terrible towels are twirling, and they go into Renegade, and the crowd goes nuts. You know what the crowd did this time? They booed. That's what they did this time. Nobody was hearing it. Nobody was feeling it. The crowd was disgusted, as was I. And that was a performance that you want to forget. Performance of a lifetime on a negative side, unfortunately. So the Jets had a really great game. Let's see who else had a great game. There were some really good plays. Washington's wide receiver had an amazing catch. I mentioned that the Jets won. Cleveland laid an egg. They got whooped. That's not really all that surprising. Indianapolis lost. That was surprising. The Vikings, I think they might have even got shut out by Seattle. What the heck? I mean, I think a lot of pundits thought the Vikings were going to be good coming into this season, and they're just not. And Indy is starting to show their colors. They are not a top-notch team. On the other hand, Denver continues to roll. So these are all kind of surprising things. I think maybe the Jets are the most surprising on the upside, and the Steelers are probably the most surprising on the downside. They stink. The Aaron Rodgers experiment has got to be over. The fans are calling from the stands. The refrain from the stands is fire Tomlin. Pittsburgh fans have had enough of mediocrity. And yeah, I know people are going to say, oh, well, Pittsburgh fans are so entitled. They just expect to win. Well, yeah, they do expect to win. What's wrong with that? They expect to win. And we haven't won a playoff game since 2016, almost 9 years, right? And we haven't been good during all of that time. The last few years have been, we've been through, what, 6 different quarterbacks, 3 different offensive coordinators. The offense is so predictable and so pathetic and so bad that the defense knows exactly what plays are going to be run. The only common denominator here for the Steelers, because they've changed quarterbacks, they've changed offensive coordinators, the common denominator here, Mike Tomlin. And the fans know it, and they've seen enough. Will the Steelers fire Mike Tomlin? It's not the way they do business. It's not likely. But what are the Steelers going to do? They're going to draft somebody as a quarterback in the draft this upcoming year. In the meantime, they're probably going to lose. They got 5 games left. They're probably going to lose at least 3 of them. They might lose all 5. If they lose all 5, I would expect Tomlin to resign. There's nothing else he can do besides resign. It would just be pathetic. And it'd be time. He needs to go. He's an anachronism, which means that he's still coaching the old way. like it was, you know, year 2000 or year 1990. And the rules have changed. The rules are much in favor of offense these days in the NFL. They favor it when you try to play offense, and the Steelers don't try to play offense. They throw every ball outside the numbers, outside the hash marks. They don't throw across the middle. They don't do square ins. They don't run post patterns. There's very few plays left that the Steelers run. It's just constant dump the ball off to a back, dump the ball off to a wide receiver, try to get 3 yards. And if you're going to keep doing that, guess what the defense is going to do? They're going to play that. They're going to say, hey, we know what they're going to do. Let's move up and let's stop this. And they did. The Steelers had against, I believe, the worst rushing defense in the league was Buffalo coming into this game. Worst rushing defense. The Steelers had 57 yards of rushing in this game. So, you know, probably the most craziest thing that happened on the downside was the Steelers forgot to show up. The best thing that happened on the upside. Oh, and by the way, the Rams lost too. That's pretty big. They lost to Carolina. Carolina's coming on, guys. Just saying. And the Rams? How do you lose to Carolina? You're talking about being maybe the best team in the NFC? Or is it the Bears? Is this Super Bowl going to be terrible or what? Who's going to be in this Super Bowl? Every time the pundits anoint a team and say, oh, it's Detroit. Detroit's the best in the NFC. And, you know, the Steelers are the best in the AFC, or the Patriots are the best in the AFC. No, they go on a losing streak and they come back to the pack. So, I don't know. The only team that's not on a losing streak is Denver. So, I guess Denver's the best team in the AFC. That's pretty shocking. Would we all be greatly surprised if Denver was in the Super Bowl? That's ridiculous. How could Denver be in the Super Bowl? They're not even good. Where's Kansas City? They're going to be out of the playoffs. Unreal. Anyway, that's all we have for the NFL and for Whiskey Shenanigans for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Upcoming now is a clip of our next episode. And hey, hope you enjoyed Thanksgiving. Have a great weekend. Well, hello, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are really excited. We are here at Burnt Church Distillery in South Carolina. Where are we? Buford?
Bluffton,
South Carolina. Bluffton. I always get those mixed up. Buford is the name of the county.
That's right.
And, you know, I should know better because I've got a house on Hilton Head, which is only half an hour from here.